he's doing this two-tone test, the ratio of his input power signals of the two tones is an extremely accurate mathematical formula. You can calculate at each microsecond or millisecond exactly how much power is going in, because it's changing in a very characteristic manner when you're doing a two-tone test. By the same token, the output spectrum that's now created, anything that's non-linear in that amplifier will create other products that you'll see in that spectrum analyzer. So it's a very sensitive test. If you've got a real good spectrum analyzer which can display 100 decibels of dynamic range on that screen, and you properly do that test, and you see some product, a third order intermodulation distortion, that is, let me pick a number, 80 decibels weaker than each of the two tones, so you've got an undesired signal 80 dB weaker than the two tones. A good spectrum analyzer can fairly easily resolve that on the screen. Your next question is going to be, what degree of nonlinearity is that representing? Let me drop. I don't know the exact number, but it's calculatable. If I had an amplifier that created a third order intermodulation distortion products, a pair of them, that are 80 dB down, that might represent a nonlinearity of the amplifier that's 0.001 dB. And I'm not kidding. Something very, very minor. You try to resolve an amplitude error of 0.001 dB with any reasonable laboratory instrumentation, unless you're the National Bureau of Standards, you cannot do that. Yet this two-tone test with a good spectrum analyzer can easily resolve that. So I know that the first time you hear all this jazz, it doesn't make a lot of sense. It's not easy to understand. You're in good company if you're having trouble with this one. Take my word for it. It's a very precise, very severe test of an amplifier that has the capability of resolving extremely minor amounts of distortion of nonlinearity of your amplifier. It's a very sensitive test. Now you get some idea as to why it has become the gold standard for measuring linearity. It is a slightly more severe test than this one. Let me. A slightly more severe test, which has been done under military requirements, is where you don't do a two-tone test, you do a three-tone test. You put in three simultaneous tones. Two of those tones are fixed in frequency, and the third tone, you sweep it across the whole band of interest. A very severe test. I won't go into that one. Take my word for it. You get an amplifier that passes that test. That's a damn good amplifier. Probably going to have some more questions on this one, John, and maybe other people will. But I'd like to believe there's a good book somewhere that's going to explain this. Way back when single sideband was just starting to become popular in the middle and late 1950s, there were a number of manuals that explained all this at that time. KC2WGB, K2RIW, the text net. And the tech net. Who are we? I'm starting to forget after all these years, John.
That's all right. That's okay. I just want Steve, the fellow who asked this question, I want him to realize that he can go to Mike One's website and he can review this information over and over again. And if he has any further questions, I invite him to email me again, and we'll go over any problem that he has with the description, maybe in one or two areas. But I want him to realize from what you're saying, if you were to take those two generators and put them at one cycle difference between the two of them, and put them into a combiner, connect that to his oscilloscope, he will see that pulse like a heartbeat going up and down. Is that what you're describing to him? This is something he could do. I think he has that basic equipment.
Yeah, absolutely. That's very doable. Depending on how you set the oscilloscope, you can get various kinds of display out of it. I heard somebody on the input say that he really liked that explanation that I just gave. However, I don't think he had his PL tone turned on. He didn't come through the repeater. Who was that person who just said that he liked that particular explanation? Who was that?
Hello?
the guy said he's going to remain anonymous. He's been listening to me for 25 years. I'd love to know who he is. He appreciated that test. Obviously, he's got very good taste. A mystery person again. Want to come back? KQLAW. Okay. He's a person who said he's been listening to us for 25 years, John. But he's going to remain anonymous. I heard him on the input, but he doesn't have his PL tone turned on, so he didn't come through the machine. Now, you just asked me a question. Oh, yes. By setting the two signal generators, if they're running from a common reference, well, maybe it doesn't have to be a common reference. You have to make sure that the two signals, you try to set two signal generators, one hertz apart. You have to now stop worrying about the rate of drift of your two signal generators. If they're both frequency synthesized, running from the same reference oscillator, that's, the 10 meg reference oscillator, that's not a problem. However, very few signal generators have knobs that go all the way down to 1 hertz of resolution. I think 1 kilohertz is about the lowest you get on most signal generators. But you could do this with audio signal generators. Now, by the way, you can do a two-tone test of a hi-fi audio amplifier by putting in, let me pick a number, an 800 hertz signal and a 1 kilohertz signal. You could combine them with a resistor divider network out of 2 audio signal generators, and you can take that composite signal and put it into your hi-fi amplifier. Now you've got the good news is that it's doing a beautiful test of the linearity of your hi-fi amplifier. Now you've got a problem of finding a spectrum analyzer that can resolve such small differences in frequency. Most of the spectrum analyzers I'm familiar with at radio frequencies, they have trouble getting down to these very narrow separations. But I'll bet somebody... Oh, wait a minute now.
HD-141 might do it, Dick.
Yeah, Hewlett-Packard makes a couple of what is it now called? Intermodulation distortion. The distortion analyzer. Hewlett-Packard makes a distortion analyzer. I've used that distortion analyzer. Let me think about that now.
9.
That sounds like it might have been the number. Hewlett-Packard does make a distortion analyzer. It works by a slightly different process. It nulls out the signal that's going in and looks at everything that's left over on that distortion analyzer. So it's measuring harmonics. It's not quite a two-tone test. But Hewlett-Packard does make some very good audio testing equipment that can measure distortion of amplifiers all the way up to at least a megahertz, down to numbers like a few hertz. So distortion measurements, there's a whole art and science to doing that. Amplifier linearity, there's various ways of doing it that are a little bit non-common sense at first, but when you do it correctly, my goodness, do those tests have resolution. Over to you, John, KQLAW in the TechNet.
Well, I agree with Mr. Anonymous. I think that was an excellent explanation and quite thorough. A lot of information there. He'll review that a couple of times, and if he has more questions, he'll email me, I'm sure. I have a HP-141 spectrum analyzer, rather. Now, that one might be able to do it. That's a good thing for me to try out. I've never tried that, but that might work. All right, that's it for the mailbag. I think we should go over to Paul. It's 10 after, and see what's happening in the space world. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Yeah, you're low-frequency head of your 141 Hewlett-Packard spectrum analyzer, which goes down to 30 kilohertz for testing an IF strip, for instance, of a receiver, which is running at 455 KC. That'll do a beautiful job. To test an audio amplifier, where you're really caring about how good is the linearity for signals in the vicinity of 1 kilohertz, a 1 kilohertz tone, you know, something like that. To test that, you really want to create a signal generator that goes down that low, and you want to look for the distortion products down that low. So a spectrum analyzer that doesn't go below 30 kilohertz, you could test your audio amplifier at 30 kilohertz if you want to, but that's not where you use it. Your loudspeakers don't work there. Your hearing doesn't work there. Do you see the problem with that one, John? Over to you, John, K2LAW.
Yeah, but I think with that frequency range, I'm going to give it a shot when I get a chance. It'd be interesting. But, yeah, a lot of fun there, and a lot of things to take into consideration when you're doing that kind of test. And is that the one they call the Sinan test?
Without a doubt, the Sinan test, the 12 dB Sinan test, is something that's used for RF frequency. Do they do a Sinan test at audio? I don't think so. I just realized something, though, John. Sitting in your laboratory is a piece of test equipment that will do this beautiful test on a hi-fi amplifier. It's called the Hewlett-Packard 8563, I think it is. Your dynamic signal analyzer. That thing will measure literally 0 to 100 kilohertz. And depending on how you set the controls, it has a resolution of millihertz. It is not doing it by a sweeping bandpass filter. It's doing it by digital signal processing.
Yes, you've got a half hour to wait for it to bin up.
Got it. But if you want to now measure the linearity of your hi-fi audio amplifier, and you've got a pair of audio signal generators that you're combining, the dynamic signal analyzer will do a beautiful test. I think it's 8563. Is that the model number on that thing? Or 3563, I think, is the Hewlett-Packard model number. Is that true, John?
61A. The 62 is the 2-port one.
Okay. 61 is the last two digits. What's the first two digits? It's a four-digit number.
I think you're right. I think 3561. I know it's a 61A.
Okay. A Hewlett-Packard 3561. If you ever get your hands on one of those, as John has, that's one of the most beautiful pieces of test equipment that Hewlett-Packard ever made. It's an oldie but goodie. I think they came out with that thing in, I'll pick a number, 1985 or so. And boy, does that have, for its day, it's got state-of-the-art digital signal processing. And so that will allow you to look at, you could scan 0 to 100 kilohertz linearly, logarithmically, any way you want, and you could expand that screen anywhere between 0 and 100 kilohertz all the way down so that you can resolve things of a thousandth of a hertz apart, a millihertz apart. It gives you the ability to do that. So does that thing have resolving capability of weak, undesired signals? My goodness. You could now measure the nonlinearity of your hi-fi amplifier, again, to numbers like 0.001 dB, if you know what I mean. Okay. You sure that we should only go from 2 RAW?
Well, I was just looking at the time, Dick, quarter after. I thought we should go to Paul. But, yeah, I believe I have another one here. Just give me a second. And by the way, I got another vector network analyzer in HP, and it goes to 3 gig, and it has unbelievable features, Dick. Oh, my God. I'm having a lot of fun with that. I'll let you know how I make out with that. Let me see if I can find this other question.
Yeah, tell me what is the model number of your new spectrum analyzer, or vector network analyzer, whichever it is.
Yeah, it's labeled a network analyzer, but it's a vector network analyzer. And in the manuals, it's a vector network analyzer, but on the label, on the unit, it says network analyzer. Yeah, it'll do Smith chart. It's an 8752A. It'll do... there's a one-button push for SWR. It'll do all of the graphics. It'll do polar plots. It's what a fantastic... And color screen, very good. And I'm getting an RGB monitor to go, which I spoke to Eric today about how to hook it up. And I'm going to have a large 24-inch display on that, which I'll be able to see for the whole length of the bench. Good stuff.
In the early days, Hewlett-Packard was extremely conservative. So that thing, by your and my standards, it is a vector network analyzer, but on the front panel, HP only called it a network analyzer. Reminds me also of when Hewlett-Packard first came out with their HP 35, 45, 49, 50, these handheld devices, they call it a calculator. When you look at the number of functions it's got and the computing power it's got, it is a computer. A computer is a much higher class calculator. And on the front panel of this handheld device, they call it calculator. It really is a computer. Over to you, John.
John.
Another thing, with the 61A that we were just speaking about, the ubiquitous analyzer, you have to realize that all of that is inboard. You need no external computer to do all of that binning and all of those calculations that it does. That's fantastic for all of that stuff to be in that little instrument.
It sure is. So what's your third one, John?
And for the TDR function, that's a good one.
Yes, TDR does that also. And it does it in both step response or peak response. What a piece of equipment. Beautiful. All right, let me go on to this next question. This young amateur has a hum in his equipment. He knows it's an open capacitor or a leaky capacitor. Let me let it drop. He's located the cap. It's an 80 mic at 250 volts. It's a section in a can. He wants to know, he has a 100 mic at 450. Is there any problem with using that because of the higher voltage and the 20 mics more? We had a question similar to this about 3 weeks ago, but he'd like to know if it would be safe and if it would change anything making that sub. Subbing an 80, that's the existing one, with a 100 mic at a considerably higher voltage.
With rare exception, I think the answer is no problem. Go to it. Because one of the sections of the composite filter capacitor, and I'm assuming this filter capacitor, is part of the rectifier network and filter network of a power supply. That's part of this amplifier.
That's correct.
Part of this amplifier has got the hum. So you think that's correct. Because a section has failed, whether or not you take that 100 mic 450 volt and simply put it in parallel with that section, that's the quick and dirty way. If you want to do it super conservative, you disconnect the old 80 microfarad section and just plug the capacitors. Making sure that the voltage rating is high enough is the right way to go. And to use a voltage rating that's even higher yet, with rare exception, other than a little bit of extra volume, there is no disadvantage. It's just being more conservative. In the case of power supplies, you might ask yourself the question, why didn't the original manufacturer put in 100 microfarads? And the answer, because he was saving money. 80 mics was just barely enough, and he shipped it that way. So in the case of filter capacitors for a power supply filter network and for the rectifier, more capacitance is almost always good. More voltage rating of the capacitors is almost always good. It is really always good. There's only one slight exception to this. Let me drop. In the old days, when people used to have a filter network for a transmitter, which had an input filter capacitor, a swinging choke in between capacitor number one and capacitor number two, and then a second filter capacitor. The choke in between, they called it a swinging choke because it would slightly change in inductance as a function of current going through it. It had a slight saturation characteristic to it. And so when you did it, when you aligned that just right, as you loaded that power supply down, the choke went into lower inductance numbers. Therefore, instead of the voltage fading out of your power supply, it tended to stay constant. When you use a swinging choke technique and set it up just right, as you double the loading on the power supply, instead of it coming down 20 volts, it stayed at the exact same voltage. That's the good news. Now, in that particular case, if you put a really big filter capacitor on the output of that swinging choke filter network, there's a slim possibility that you hit the magic number where the choke plus that capacitor runs into resonance at 60 hertz or 120 hertz, the ripple filter out of a full-wave rectified power supply. And so you could get some funny effects with that swinging choke when you hit resonance. But very few people nowadays use the swinging choke technique. Let me drop. And as such, more capacitance is almost always good. The more, the merrier. And if you ran a set of experiments where you plugged in 80 mics, 100 mics, 200 mics, 500 mics, 1,000 mics, and you did some careful measurements, you would suddenly discover that the hum is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, assuming that all the hum you're seeing is coming from the power supply. You've got to be careful with certain audio amplifiers, because maybe the input network is not properly shielded, and there's a power transformer nearby, there could be a sneak path by which magnetic coupling is taking place, and that's creating hum. In which case, a better filter maybe is not going to be able to knock it down, because that's not the cause of the hum. But as long as you're fairly sure the hum is coming from the power supply, and you can confirm that pretty fast, you can put your oscilloscope probe on that power supply, make sure it's a 10-to-1 probe, make sure it's rated for the voltage that you've got, and set your oscilloscope for AC coupling, not DC coupling. And now you can actually measure the waveform, the peak-to-peak, a ripple component of your power supply. And you can see the real ripple that's on that 80 mic that you believe has dried out. And by the way, electrolytic capacitors do have a nasty aging failure mode where as they dry out after time, after some number of years, the total number of microfarads starts going down to very small numbers. Let me drop. This is the major problem that happens 98% of the time on an antenna rotator. The CDE, Cornell Duvalier antenna rotators, were very popular in the early days of ham radio, 10, 20 years ago. On some winter day, you ask the rotator to rotate clockwise and it doesn't move. And you give it a command and you wait for a while and all of a sudden it starts to move. And you think you've got some ice build up on the rotator, or you think the grease has become too stiff because it's cold outside. You do enough study and you find out that the 120 microfarad AC electrolytic capacitor that's in the control network on the bench with you, that's required to give the 90 degrees of phase shift that creates the rotating vector inside of that motor on top of your tower. If that 120 microfarad capacitor dries out and goes down to, let me pick a number, 10 microfarads, all of a sudden your turning torque that used to be a large number of foot-pounds goes down to nothing, and so it doesn't even rotate anymore. And you can go to the store in those days and buy that exact capacitor, brand new off the shelf, plug it in, and it doesn't fix the problem. You suddenly realize what's happening is that that AC electrolytic capacitor sitting on the shelf at the store was drying out, even though it wasn't being used. And so it has marked on 120 microfarads, and by the time you get it into your hands, it's down to 10 microfarads, and it's not going to work the circuit anymore. The bottom line is you don't put in the one that was recommended by CDE. You go out and buy a motor start capacitor that has the right voltage rating and the right number of microfarads, and they're a lot more rugged. They're a little bit larger in size. You may have to mount it on the outside because it doesn't squeeze inside of the box, the control box. But you put a real motor start capacitor in there, and all of a sudden you'll have all kinds of torque you've never had before.
Repeater, timeout.
So drying out electrolytic capacitors is a real problem. The Heathkit SB200 and 220, half kilowatt and 1 kilowatt amplifiers, has a whole bunch of DC, but it's got electrolytic capacitors in there. And almost any one of those amplifiers you buy these days is going to be a large number of years old. And you do a thorough enough test and you'll find that those capacitors have gone down to very small numbers. And sometimes they even become a short circuit. So they do require replacement. So that's a very common failure of a popular kind of capacitor. With age, they dry out and go down a very small number of microfarads, no longer do their function. KC2 WGB, K2RIW, the TechNet.
KC2 WGB, very good. Now, I want to reiterate what you said, very important. When you're replacing this actual 80 mic he's going to put on that can multi-section, he should disconnect the can. It's failed, it's open, but it's possible it could give other problems. So that is very important to disconnect that can and just find a way to mount the single cap or get a can that has all of the featured values that you need and voltages and replace the whole can. But to you, Dick.
Yeah, that is the conservative way of doing it. Now, to replace that can, and that can may be a three-section capacitor, two-section or three-section, to find that exact can today, in many cases, is going to be very difficult. You've got a vanishing vendor problem. That can probably no longer exists. And the 80 mic section is the one that he is now investigating because it dried out. The other one or two sections of that can are also suspicious. Because if one section dried out, there's a good chance the other sections have also dried out. So whatever the other two sections are doing, if you had the right kind of instrumentation where you could measure the number of microfarads that are left, if he measured that 80 mic, I bet you he's going to find something like 5 mics is left, or even less. And if he measures the other two sections, they're going to be down to much lower numbers. Now, maybe they're not in as critical a section of the whole amplifier, so maybe that's not a problem. But to go one step more being conservative, even the other capacitors of that, the other sections of that capacitor should probably also be bypassed and replaced. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Yes, in that case, he will have to purchase the other two capacitors, this 100 mic he has, so that's a quick fix. But yeah, you're probably right. If he looks at it and you see that, what looks like sand coming out of the bottom, but it coagulates, oil and wax that's coming out of it. If that's coming out of the cap, I think all of the sections should be changed because eventually he's going to have trouble. Yeah, I concur with that.
Okay, we're about to go over to Paul. Paul, although it's a little bit all out of the space area, I'm going to bring to your attention and other people's attention that the November issue of Smithsonian Magazine has a very nicely done article on, I forget the exact wording, but the guy who's done really great work, and he's now a candidate for one of these great big awards, so I can't think of the name of it.
Nobel
Award, yes. He's a candidate for a Nobel Prize because he's done some extremely good work on detecting neutrinos. He has built, arguably the world's biggest neutron detector. He built this array of neutron detectors that go down something like a couple of thousand feet, and is about these individual strings of scintillation counters that were sunk into the ice of the South Pole. And this thing is a couple of kilometers north-south, and a couple of kilometers east-west, and a couple of thousand feet deep. That chunk of ice has become one huge scintillation counter with thousands and thousands of detectors that were sunk into the ice. The trouble with neutrinos, let me drop A6DPZ with a comment. Yeah, are you familiar with that one, Hal? Go ahead, Hal.
I wanted to make a comment that when you were talking about capacitors, I had a problem on high standing wave. So Dick mentioned about the rotor capacitor. In a pinch, you could take two 210 microfarad capacitors, electrolytics, tie them back to back and throw them in, and they work perfectly for a motor starting capacitor for a rotator. That's my comment. Also, the other thing is, if one cap or the three-stage cap goes bad, replace all the sections, because if one's going to go, the other ones are bound to go very shortly. It's K6DPV with a quickie comment.
Yeah, very fine, Hal. Looks like he's also in favor of changing all three of that section. And putting two non-AC electrolytic capacitors, DC type, back-to-back is okay in a pinch. I'm not so sure that I would trust that for a long period of time without putting back-to-back diodes across the capacitors to make sure they don't see the wrong polarity of voltage. And an electrolytic capacitor that sees the reverse voltage is doing some damage. So putting a pair of them back-to-back to act as a poor man's AC electrolytic, I recommend putting diodes across them. I wonder if you've seen that recommendation about the diodes, Al. K6DPZ, K2LIW.
I've seen that, but I've had rotators that have worked for many years, you know, just reversing the caps, and I haven't had any failures. So either way you could do it. You could go, you know, put a couple of diodes. I didn't bother, and I ran CDR rotators with control boxes.
Okay, good to know. So now getting back to this, the latest issue, the November issue of Smithsonian Magazine, has this beautiful article about, I can't think of the man's name, who is a beautiful theorist working for University of Minnesota, I think it is, and he proposed this huge neutrino detector. The problem with neutrinos is that, on average, a neutrino can go through literally 50 million miles of solid steel before it has a 1-to-1, a 50% chance of hitting anything. These things are so good at penetrating because they're nearly zero in mass, absolutely zero in charge. They interact with nothing. So to build a neutrino detector, you have to start off with an extremely big volume of sensitive detector, and you hope that one in a trillion will hit something in there and you get an indication. So he built this really huge array at the South Pole. It's doing a beautiful job of detecting these super strong neutrinos, which happen when you get a supernova, or when you get black holes hitting each other. When you get a really major event, you produce these extremely strong neutrinos. He's built a detector that is now sensing those. WS2N, a spaceman, K2LIW, go ahead, Paul.
This is WS2N. I remember when those things were put in, I think they were onesies. When they drilled into the ice, or they heated the ice or something, and as they went down, they would just let these things freeze over. You know, you couldn't protect them, so they're in there forever. But I never heard the results, so apparently they must have got results out of that test. Now this guy's on the way for a Nobel Peace Prize. I assume that's it. I wanted to make a statement before we even start with any of the topics that I had, in case anybody wants to go to sleep early. Tomorrow, you will be able to see an Antares Cygnus launch. If you look to the southwest, and if you have a low horizon, say 15 degrees, if no trees or buildings or something like that, and it's launched from Wallops Island, Virginia. And it's got two rockets, two engines for this thing, so it pushes like 700,000 pounds of thrust to push the Cygnus spacecraft up to the International Space Station to give it 5,000 pounds worth of supplies. So it'll be visible from Long Island as long as you have that low horizon available to you. I'm not sure what you have there, Dick. You might have to go halfway up the tower. But I'm going to try to find something nearby here. Even a big parking lot would be good. You know, a school or something like that. And if the area has Wi-Fi, you can bring your tablet.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
644. Now, I also heard 645 is the number at night, and that'll be dark. You know, it gets dark early now. So let me just mention that before I go on. Back to you, Dick, about the neutrino detectors. There's a lot of neutrino detectors around, and I guess this guy must be hitting pay dirt.
Yeah, let me backtrack on this one now. 6:45 p.m. local Eastern Daylight Saving Time tomorrow. 6:45 p.m. is when we should look to the southwest to see this launch from Wallops Island. Is that true, Paul? Not a.m., 6:45 p.m. at night. And by 6:45 p.m., we are not fully dark, but it's way beyond sunset these days. Go ahead.
Hey, it's pretty dark. I was driving around at 6:45 tonight. What is it? Every day it's almost a minute later. So it's going to be pretty good. They're considering it the first Antares launch at night. The other ones, which went up in the daytime, if you have that same view, you still saw this as long as the weather was permitting. And tomorrow it's supposed to be clear. I've already looked at the reports. So, looks good. It's only about, 250 miles away as the crow flies. So, in fact, you can see it. If you were on a beach in Massachusetts, you'd be able to see it. So, I mean, it's... If you're down in D.C., of course, you know, the closer you get to Washington, the better off you are. And the reason you only see it for 15 degrees, it's being launched and going... You know, off to the east, you know, the southeast. So, before you know it, it's going over the horizon. So, that's why we get about 15 degrees out of it. But they're two big engines. They're these rebuilt Russian engines. They've upgraded for the Antares launch vehicle. And Cygnus also has an upgraded secondary booster, Castor XL, and so that's why they're able to bring up 5,000 pounds instead of normally around 3,800 pounds. It's a longer rocket. So that's pretty much it. Back to you, Dick.
So it blasts off from Wallops Island. It goes to the southeast from Wallops Island, Virginia. So I think you're saying we will see it 15 degrees above our southwest horizon. That's its maximum altitude. I'm guessing we're going to see it for something like 30 seconds or so before it disappears over the horizon. Is that roughly the prediction, Paul? Go ahead.
I haven't seen it myself, but usually about 1 minute after launch, and that's why their website, they said 6:44, and then if you read some of the other ones, space.com, they're saying 6:45, so, and it has to go off on time. They don't have a window, because their goal is to get to the space station. So, you could look for it like 1 minute after launch, and you should see it for about 15, 20 seconds. I've heard reports from hams in Connecticut that saw it for 30 seconds. A couple of guys on the beach here, I think they were down by Jones Beach, they saw it for a while. And that was daytime. So, and they also saw the other launch that they did in Hatter. Launch that same company, Orbital Science, sent it to the moon. That was the Lottie mission, but that was a different rocket. So there you go, Dick. That should be pretty interesting. Talking about resupplying the International Space Station, the Dragon spacecraft is now disembarked from the space station and has returned to Earth safely. Parachute and landed in the Pacific Ocean down by Baja, California. And that's been attached to the space station for the last little over a month. They unloaded 5,000 pounds of supplies, put 3,600 pounds into it, and brought that back to science experiments, things that they bring back on the Dragon equipment. And that's pretty good. And some questions that have been asked of me is, you know, they heard the Dragon cargo spacecraft was supposed to be reusable. And at first it was, but NASA knocked that down. They felt it was an untried system. They're paying for new. Every time we send one up from SpaceX, they wanted a new cargo spacecraft. So that's what they're getting. So they have a contract for 12 of those things. I think they're up to five, going on five now.
Repeater, timeout.
Can't believe it. Well, I missed it.
Your timing was perfect. You only timed out for 1 second, Paul. Go ahead.
Okay, very good. The Dragon crew mission, now that's going to be different. That's got, you know, things that this one doesn't have. The cargo vehicle. It'll be completely equipped for human transport. It'll have propulsion rockets on board. 8 of them. 16,000 pounds of thrust on each rocket. That will be two purposes. In case there's an emergency at takeoff, it'll be a pusher system to push the spacecraft away from the booster rockets, you know, away from the first stage. And the second purpose would be re-entry. It'll come through the atmosphere, it'll have a heat shield, and they'll have a propulsive landing all the way down to the ground without parachutes. So different animal, and that will be equipped to be sent up 10 different flights per vehicle. So that's a different story. But the cargo vehicles that you keep seeing going up are all brand new. They're not reusing them. There you go. In the news last week, a few days ago, China did have a launch from China to the moon. They launched a rocket, relatively larger vehicle, similar to their Shenzhou spacecraft, which is the ones that have launched people into space to the moon. It's unmanned, and it'll be going around the moon and coming back. Originally, I heard reports that it was just going to go around the moon and come back. Then I heard other reports that it was going to have retro rockets go into orbit around the moon. And the latest reports I heard go back to the original, that this is supposed to be going around the moon, one loop around, a merry-go-round, and then back to Earth, testing out heat shields, testing out the ability to do something like this. There are next goal is a year or two away, where they plan on sending a similar spacecraft. This time they plan on landing it, the Chang 5 they call it, that's going to land on the moon, pick up some rocks, and bring it back. So it's a sample return mission, similar to what the Russians did back in the 70s with their space program. Of course, we bought a lot of rocks back, but we did it with people. We put 12 people there, bought them back, and that was all in the early 1970s. So they got a long way to go. Let me drop it. But it's amazing to see some of these countries, China, now India, involved, sending a rocket spacecraft to Mars. Orbiting Mars, they've orbited the moon, and India has plans on having their own manned mission a couple of years from now as well. So everything's space lately. I want to bring up a test that these six people are involved in Hawaii. I don't know if you saw this thing on the internet or anything, but this is the second time around to do this. It's being funded by NASA. They have a dome about 36 feet in diameter, two stories high, so it's a two-floor system, and they went in there last week, and they plan on staying for 8 months, and they have a commander, a woman commander from Canada, and they just want to see how they can cope. If they plan on going to Mars, they've got to be able to figure that they have to stay on Mars for this period of time, so they want to stay in this case their so-called landing craft, which is 36 feet diameter. They have an external airlock system. They've locked themselves into this thing for the next 8 months. Anytime they want to go outside, if you want to go outside, you go into the airlock, put on a spacesuit, and off you go. And there's nothing around in this place. In fact, the place is not even powered by commercial mains. They don't even have generators. They have a solar panel field, and that's giving them the electricity in case they have a lot of cloudy days or something. Their backup electrical system is a fuel cell, you know, just similar to what you would have on a spacecraft or if you're sitting on Mars. You know, you're going to have these maybe fuel cells. Maybe I'd want a couple of RTGs up there supplying some extra power too, you know. But that's what they're doing. That is the second mission. The first one was, a year or so ago. Now that was the four-month mission. This is 8 months, and they're going to have one more 12-month mission, which should coincide with Kelly, he's an astronaut. He'll be going to the International Space Station for 1 year with a Russian. That should be interesting. See how he makes out. They're practicing for long duration missions. They really need to get this down to about 3 years. You know, you figure 10 months there, you know, maybe 6 to 8 months on the planet, and then maybe another 10 months back. You know, you've got to be able to do 3 years comfortably to do what they're really involved with. So we'll see how that mission goes. And some high location, I think it's like 8,000 feet on a mountaintop in Hawaii. They have food in there, and they have bedrooms. It's a pie-shaped setup with the bedrooms on the second floor. So they get 6 bedrooms downstairs. They have a little exercise facility, kitchen and all. And, we'll see, 3 men and 3 women. Also in the news, a balloon jump followed this Australian guy 2 years ago, Felix Baumgartner. I remember talking about him on the net quite a bit. He's the guy that jumped 23 miles, went up in a balloon on a gondola, jumped out of this thing, broke the sound barrier on the way down. Well, this other guy, just a couple of days ago, Alan Ustace, I think his name is, I can't pronounce it, E-U-S-T-A-C-E. He's 57 years old, so he's not a kid. He's vice president of Google. Hooked himself up to this balloon. They've been working on this for 3 years. Not a gondola. Somehow he was suspended from this helium balloon. Took him up now 25 miles and blew this guy's record away, which was only 2 years old. And on the way down, he got up to over 800 miles per hour. Again, broke the sound barrier. So I thought that was pretty cool. He took off from, of all places, Roswell, New Mexico, Dick. So filled it up with 35,000 cubic feet of helium and sat in this balloon for a couple of hours until he got to height. And he cut himself loose and took a dive. But interesting enough, he found out he was involved with this guy Tabor McFarlane. Tabor was one of the original Biosphere 2 people, which ironically I was reading a book recently about his wife, Jane Poitner, and she wrote the book. And they were both part of the mission to in Biosphere 2. Well, before they got out, they established a company, a space company called Paragon, and they're still in business today. This guy from Google, the vice president, got together with Paragon and Tabor, and he helped them do this because this company is involved, happens to be involved in setting up balloon flights with a big gondola. It'll be able to carry six people. Almost like a shirt sleeve environment. And they'll carry them up to a similar height. And the gondola will separate from the balloon, and they'll float down that way with the parasail. So, interesting things going on all the way around, Dick. That's pretty much all I have. Any questions for me, I'll be here, or I keep forgetting to get my email out. It's spacenetreport@gmail.com. Dick, over to you. K2RIWWS2N. Space Report for the TechNet.
I may have a mixed up memory here, Paul, but I think I heard somewhere that that first Chinese rocket that's going to the moon is going to do a figure eight around the moon and then come right back, or maybe go behind the moon in orbit for a couple of orbits and then come back. But I think I remember reading somewhere that there's a piece of amateur radio electronics on board, which will be transmitting signals. Did I remember that incorrectly? Back to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RAW.
Yes, I mentioned that about 4 or 5 weeks ago when this first came out, maybe longer, I don't know, time gets away from me. And yeah, they do have a transmit, 1.5 watts or something. And they said it's the equivalent to listening to a moon-bound signal. So if you have Joe Taylor's program and equipment, and I forget what frequencies they're going to be transmitting on, you should be able to pick this up. But yes, you're right. Your memory's not failing there.
Now, if that was on 432 or 2 meters or 6 meters, 1 watt from the lunar distance is not a difficult signal to listen to. I think it's a little bit easier than moon bounce. I know that 1,300 or 1,500 miles of the signal from the space shuttle with Owen Garriott transmitting with a Motorola handy talkie into a simple foil antenna taped to the window of the space shuttle. I'll be amazed if he had 1 watt of output. But from 1,500 miles, that was a potent signal for me to listen to with just a simple ground plane mag mount antenna on my automobile. He didn't hear me, but I heard him, and he was dead full quieting. I can easily do the calculation as to, in the case of FM, no way in hell are you going to hear a 1 watt signal from a lunar distance. But with a single sideband receiver, I'm going to run a couple of calculations as to how much antenna gain you need to be able to hear that at a lunar distance. So 1 watt, if that's the effective radiated power, I think a good sideband receiver can hear that with maybe as much as 1 Yagi. Let me grab. So I'm going to double check that one. And I suspect it would be easier to do, I was going to say easier on 432 than 6 meters. Now I'm not sure. I'll have to figure that one out too. When it comes to the man from Google going to a higher altitude and then coming down, there's a limit as to how far you can do this from pole. As you go to higher and higher altitudes, you're going to run into a heating problem. You and I know that if somebody in a spacesuit was at a lunar distance and you carefully put him right at the equal gravity point between Earth and Moon and just shove him a little bit closer to the Earth, so that now he's going to go from that equal gravity point, he's now going to fall toward the Earth. He would hit the Earth at around 20,000 miles an hour, and he would burn up. Without a heat shield, he'd be in a heap of trouble. So as you launch somebody at a higher and higher altitude and let them drop free fall into the atmosphere, eventually you get to an altitude where the velocity they hit the atmosphere with is going to create significant excess heating. I wonder if anyone's ever mentioned at what altitude you start running into that heating problem, Paul. I know that the guy who did it before Google, he did run into a atmospheric stability problem. I think he was spinning or tumbling in a way that was kind of uncomfortable. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, apparently this Paragon company helped him with this. Some kind of carbon fiber thing that he was hooked up to with the parachute. There was no way he was going to get tangled up into this. I haven't seen the what it looked like or anything. All I saw was the still picture of this guy up in his balloon. But the I don't have enough details. But this guy Tabor from Paragon, guy from one of the guys who was young at the time, the biosphere, and spent 2 years in that 3.5 acre enclosed facility in Arizona, now running Paragon, helped him out with this with the problem of spinning. He did roll two times. They weren't worried about that. You know, he wasn't trying to do any flips, but he did. And whatever system he had, he had solved that. And also, a heating problem, you're talking about velocity, you know, creating heat. There's another heating problem. Higher up you go in the stratosphere, you start to get, it actually starts to get hotter again, according to what I was reading about this guy. And there's no way to get rid of the heat because you don't have, it's almost like a vacuum. And you don't have a good way to eliminate the heat. Whatever system this guy came up with, that problem is solved as well. We gotta have him figured out what he did or how he did it. Some kind of a visor capability to make sure his visor wasn't gonna fog up. They found ways around that. The Paragon Space System is a good group.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And fascinated with the space program. According to what I read, when he was young, a kid. And we got a question from K2 UPS. WS2N.
Very fine. You did time out, but I managed to reset the machine. I think you said that K2 UPS has a question. Let's go for that one. KTUPS. Question number one for me is, where are you? Which direction are you heading? Because that's always fun to listen to. And then go ahead with your space question. You got it, Rich. KTUPS, mobile, K2RIW and the TechNet.
Good evening, KTUPS mobile. I'm heading back to New York. I'm eastbound on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, and I just left Somerset, Pennsylvania. The one comment I have is that I did read a story that hams have heard that signal from the rocket, and I believe they were using the JT-65. And they've confirmed that they had the right message, so they proved that they heard that particular piece of space equipment. And the other thing was I had just stepped out of the trucks a little bit, so I don't know if Paul mentioned the landing of the X-37 spacecraft. But if he didn't, I wonder what he had heard about it. I saw a couple of video clips on it, and that was pretty interesting. Back to you.
You've got it, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
All right, good, Rich. Yeah, I did mention that last week. Yeah, X-37B came back. By the way, thanks for your emails, Rich. He's one of my favorite people that email me on that SpaceNet report at gmail.com.